So, Jesse, welcome to the Reverie Podcast. Thank you so much for doing this episode. Yeah. I have followed along with your work for a long time, as I'm sure a lot of guys in the indie world are, you know, like either makers or people that just love the independent Cymbalsmith movement. So I'm really excited to talk to you. Really appreciate you being on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So you're not in the States anymore. You're not in New York.
No. I left New York a little over a year ago. My wife is from Czech Republic, and so we bought a property out here that has like a separate workshop building from the house. So I have a bigger workshop space with a separate room for the lathe, and we're able to do concerts here. I'm in the workshop right now. We're able to do concerts in here. So I'm doing like a monthly house concert, and I can play in here and do all my hammering in the nice big room rather than like a basement in New York City. So that's helps for my peace of mind, you know, with my old space had no windows and
that's no fun.
Yeah, so now I got skylights here. You got the clouds, and that definitely helps out a lot.
That's awesome. Yeah, and so you were in New York City because you were gigging as a professional musician doing that. I'm interested to know, because I try to do a little bit of research on people. I mean, before the podcast, but honestly, I've followed your stuff for years. Definitely seen the video in, I think, 2012 of you going to visit Spiz. We could definitely talk about that if you want, but I'm interested to know kind of your relationship with cymbalsmithing and how it came to be, like, you know, because obviously you're a fantastic player, and I would imagine that's kind of where things started for you, but I'd love to hear your take on that.
Well, yeah, I would say my interest with cymbals started playing the main ride cymbal of my teacher, who was a really great old jazz drummer in the Bay Area, a guy named Donald Duck Bailey. Cool. And he had an old K, old stamp 22, old K that Art Blakey had given him in the late 50s. And he had played the same cymbal on every recording, every gig for over 50 years. And I used to sub on his gigs and sit in on his gigs, even when I was like 11, 12, until I was 17. And I would play on the cymbal, and it really did create like an atmosphere within the music that was really great and really special. And at the time, I didn't really know that much about any cymbal manufacturers or anything like that, but that already piqued my interest, or I thought, wow, there's something special about this particular cymbal. Then I moved to New York to study at Manhattan School of Music, and still had like that extreme interest in cymbals. But at that point, I had already, in that year before that, I was already on like the Cymbalholic forums. Mm-hmm. But more like as a 16-year-old kid, occasionally putting some very stupid post on there, but more just like in the periphery.
Yeah.
And just, you know, seeing what people were posting on there. And then when I was 17, I moved to New York, and still had the interest in cymbals. And around that time, or maybe, you know, within those few years, had found out about Roberto Spizzichino and what he was doing. So then, that was 2008. I visited Spizzichino.
Okay, 2008.
Yeah. And I got a cymbal from him that I still have, and really liked what he was doing. And then it was sometime after that, maybe more like 2011, when he passed, and I felt like there was more of a void in the cymbal world that, you know, he had been doing something really unique. And then there were some great guys who were and still are working on cymbals, but I felt like there was a certain niche that wasn't necessarily there at the time. And I originally got into it for myself, and then that started to branch out, and I was working on other people's stuff and making cymbals for them. So
yeah I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard your name come up when it's guys from New York that I make connections with, and it's like, oh yeah, Jesse. I know Jesse. He kind of like hipped me to the fact that this even was a thing, and then they kind of discover all the other people. So, yeah, that's awesome. And with your, I had two. Well, first off, really about that old K, did you ever go back and listen through that symbol on the different recordings over the 50 years to kind of even just see like how the perception of that symbol translates through the decades? Cause I feel like that'd be an interesting study almost.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely did get more clicky and more dry. And that's just from the dirt and grime and patina and the micro cracks that were in the symbol.
Yeah.
It also, by the time I was playing it, it was keyholed almost to the end of the bell. So
wow.
he never liked to use like a plastic cymbal sleeve. So that also made the bell very dry and made the cymbal hang in a different way, which made it more dry.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I love that kind of the for me, a lot of my thinking in terms of making cymbals is about kind of a twofold perspective thing where obviously you have like that listener perspective, but you're also thinking about how does it translate through mics? How does it translate in one venue versus a different venue? And then trying to think about all of those things and designing those into a cymbal. And I find that a lot of people kind of will narrowly focus on just what do they hear behind that cymbal, which to me is kind of why there's like such a lot of guys love really thin, floppy, really, really thin cymbals, you know, because it's like it doesn't hurt your ears as much. Yeah. They're like lower pitched and a little bit darker, but then you put that in a context and it maybe doesn't perform as it should. So with your, and this is maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but with your process of making cymbals, what do you find that you have a mindset or like an idea when you're going into making a cymbal of what you want it to be, or do you like to allow it to kind of manifest itself, whatever the blank wants to be? And kind of what's your relationship with the actual work and how you go about making your cymbals?
Well, these days I'm just making stuff that I like or I approve and then putting it out there. So it depends on the process, depends on the exact job, and it depends on the material. And you start to get an idea with any blank material you're using, where it can go realistically. And that starts to, based on what you do, but also just based on what it is, that starts to become pretty, you know, clear early on. I've definitely had even like custom projects for someone where they requested something that would be maybe higher profile or lower profile or, you know, in a certain way. And I start doing it, and it's not that I have to toss the material, but there's a certain point early on that I realized, oh yeah, this piece of material is not going to work for that project.
Yeah.
So it's bending things to your will to a certain point, because then you can also try to just bend things to your will, but it's going to get diminishing returns.
There's a real, I find it really does relate to music in a lot of ways, because there's like this balance between what you can control and what you can't. And oftentimes, especially with improvised music, where so much of it is the environment and it's reacting, and it really isn't about it isn't about controlling or like bending things to your will. So there's like this balance kind of interplay between what you can control and what you can't. And I agree. I think that's kind of like the process of making a cymbal. I was talking to Craig in the last episode, and he was saying that oftentimes when he's doing a commission for a customer, that he'll just grab a couple blanks and kind of work on multiples at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that to me is like, that's an example of, you know, he's doing the same method as kind of, you can control certain things, but that blank will tell you what it's wanting to become. And so, you know, it's a good technique, I guess, for guys doing commissions, just like have a couple, work on a couple blanks at the same time. And then, you know, you can fold a one that doesn't work into your inventory or whatever, you know.
And things are so subjective when it comes to cymbals, but I've gone through a process of using a micrometer and checking the exact, you know, especially when I'm making a replica of a cymbal, checking the exact thickness by area, the depth of the lathing, not only, you know, the exact size, the gram weight, the exact bevel height, all of these things. But then that is not necessarily the best way. It can get too scientific very quickly.
But that's so cool. That makes me want to get a micrometer to work to like try that, you know, because it's
Or like a graphite surface, not graphite, a granite surface plate, you know, and like to check the exact flatness. I used to have this super heavy granite surface plate, but now I just put the cymbals on a steel tabletop. Yeah, it's close enough.
Not perfect, but it'll do the job, right? Yeah.
Yeah, or in some ways better, because it doesn't, you know, perfect is, also very subjective.
Okay, so this could roll into discussing Spiz for a little bit, because he's the elephant in the room of every independent cymbalsmith is this, like, you know, the godfather or whatever. Do you find that he, I mean, I'm assuming he's a big inspiration for you, and that you kind of alluded to the fact that that sort of got your, got things like, piqued your interest really in with the cymbal smithing world. Talk to me a little bit about that experience of being at his shop, and like, what did that do? How did that spark that, that interest?
Oh, he was cool. He was a real, real crazy and spacey guy, but yeah, like very artistic and, always trying a bunch of crazy ideas. Yeah, I didn't get anything. I guess, yeah, you alluded that I'm in that video at his shop. That just so happened that the other guy,
filmed it.
Frank Malnego was there the same day and took some videos. I happened to be in there.
Nice.
He at the time I wasn't trying to make cymbals myself, or you know, or yeah. Maybe I had that in the very back of my mind, but it wasn't. I wasn't asking him about that. But just seeing the shop and how he had everything set up, gave me a lot of ideas and was inspirational for sure.
Yeah.
What I also visited when I really started being certain that I wanted to do it and was, starting to just teach myself how to work on cymbals. I was in Los Angeles at the time Matt Bettis was there, and I visited him and asked him some questions, and he gave me some really useful tips with just getting started, like which motor to buy. Like with, you know, facing hammers a little bit. There was no lesson per se, but it was he hipped me to a video from a guy named Uri Hoffi.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with
I've
that.
Heard that name, yeah.
It's just a method of hammering.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, so things like that. That was, you know, in terms of getting started.
Yeah.
With visiting Spiz Aquino, it was just a general interest or general inspiration, but nothing too specific necessarily.
Cool. So then, that's good to know. So when it comes to what inspires you, because obviously, I mean, like, I kind of get bored by talking about like maybe like the one like the really famous independent cymbalsmith guy, and we can kind of over obsess about like one dude.
Yeah,
obviously we all have our own voice, I would say, with our instruments, and kind of we all have our own inspiration, our own influences. You know, you're a jazz drummer. I'm sure you play all kinds of styles, but like, what inspires you when it comes to like your craft and what you're, because you said you're like you're making the things that you wanna, like you wanna hear. What is that? What is that sound?
Because now I realize I've seen different players playing a cymbal that I made 10 years ago, and I realized that I want to be really happy with whatever that is. If it's 50 years down the line, I still want to feel like that's great. And if it's something that someone asked me to do and I didn't feel 100% great for me about it, and then if they're going to sell it, or maybe they'll keep playing it, but then that might be the only cymbal of mine that someone in the world sees. And then they get that opinion, well, all his cymbals must be like that. So yeah. I'd rather have every single thing going out be something that that I can say, yeah, that's something that I would play on a gig. And often case it is, or, you know, can be.
Right.
Yeah. What inspires me with any particular cymbal? I think the top criteria are that you can play any part of the cymbal. The whole presumption on a cymbals of a sweet spot, I think, is absolute blasphemy.
Come on, talk about that. I like that.
Well, if you imagine the sweets, if you're talking about a piano and, you know, oh, the sweet spot, man, when you play middle C and just around there in the middle, that's great. It doesn't sound any better. Yeah, just don't play anywhere else.
Yeah, yeah, just that.
You wouldn't play that piano. You wouldn't. Yeah, if the saxophone had four good notes, the best four notes, but then the rest is awful. You're not. So you should be able to. It's for the ease of playing as well, that you can play in different areas, get different sounds. And that doesn't mean to say that it can't have weird tonalities come out, but that it's still that you say, yeah, that is playable, that I could ride on that part of the cymbal musically.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the, I think I'm at a, I told Craig this the other week, I'm at a point where I'm starting to try to, I guess maybe my next frontier to dive into is allowing for the tones, like the ugliness that can actually make a cymbal very vibey to play. And so I think there's like a transition of anybody that does any craft where you start and you emulate and you're just trying to get your technique together. You get your technique together and then you can execute. And then this, the big question after that comes like, well, okay, what do I have to say? Whether it's being a player or, you know, making a cymbal or really doing anything, I would say. But and then when you're in that zone of like, well, what do I really want to say? Oftentimes it comes down to like, well, it comes down to actually trying to get back to like a childlike state where things are less like thought of. You're not thinking about the technical aspect of like swinging the hammer in this exact way. You're trying to get back to a more playful state. And so I'm thinking of it, like, that's where my brain is a lot lately. It's like, you know, making a cymbal that maybe it does have a hum, but that hum is like balanced in a way that's musical. You can bring the hum out if you want, but it feeds the rest of the cymbal and the other parts of the cymbal in an interesting way. Cause I mean, the really super clean, beautiful sound, you know, you can get that from any major manufacturer.
Yeah, there's a huge amount of subjectivity when it comes to cymbals, because there's not one specific note that's happening. So even like all the terminology that people discuss with cymbals can get really dicey. Yeah. Although I feel like I've worked out some of those over the years being a cymbal psychologist. But but yeah, aside from, for at least for me, aside from the being able to play any part of the cymbal, and I think that is ultimately pretty objective. Like, there's some subjectivity. Someone might say, oh, that has a little more of a tone, but we've all played a cymbal where there's an unplayable area and then a playable area. So it's general. That's a pretty objective criteria. And the other aspect would be the feel. I think the feel of how it feels to play and the response is just as important as the sound, or more important, because if it feels good to play, you're going to make it sound good. And especially with a lot of these really famed drummers that we love, they could play almost any cymbal and still make it pretty much sound like them.
Yeah.
But it has to be something that feels good to play, and then they can make it sound in, you know, their style.
Yeah.
So,
and so that dives in a little bit to just, I don't know if you like the word tension or not. I know that like it's that's a buzzword we kind of throw around, and like some cymbalsmiths I've talked to hate the word tension, because they're like, what does it mean? Like like it has different meanings for different people. Easy way to say it, obviously, is like stiffness and looseness, and kind of feel, you know, because obviously, like, it's very easy to describe this, I think, talking about a drum. Like, if your drum is tuned really low, it's going to have like a really soft feel. It's not going to rebound as much. You are playing into it more. If it's tuned high, it's going to rebound. So there's like, you know, that kind of applies to the way a symbol is, and so how much it gives, and then also like the more it kind of gives, maybe the slower the response. So there's like benefits to like stiffness and benefits to looseness, and then ground.
Like with tuning a drum, you can have a floor tom tune the same pitch, but the top head is loose, the bottom head is tight, or vice versa, or the heads are even. And that affects the response that you're going to get that's more comfortable for you as the player.
Right.
But from the audience perspective, it's almost the same type of sound. So it's kind of the same with the tension of a cymbal. And I think tension is perfectly fine. I just imagine tension, if you try to push your thumb or your foot or whatever against the cymbal, how easy does it bend in?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's tension.
Right.
Is it a very stiff cymbal that has a lot of tension? It's not going to do that as easily. You need to run a truck over it.
Right.
Is it a really loose, like some of these very low tension, low profile, thin hi-hats that when you stomp your foot down, the thing inverts. That's low tension.
So that's interesting. Yeah. You kind of introduced the idea of like there being dimensions to that response and feel with a drum.
And different areas of the cymbal can have different amounts of tension, and that can be something to explore that also affects the feel. But I think it also, just like with the playability, the feel is also subjective for each person's specific taste, but ultimately like a kind of objective criteria that someone might say, well, that doesn't feel exactly how I like cymbals to feel, but that still feels good to play.
Yeah, I know what you mean. This is getting me thinking, because it makes me think about like there really are, like when you're making a cymbal, when I make cymbals for the batches that I drop, every now and then I'll make a cymbal and there's just this feeling that like, oh yeah, that's a perfectly fine cymbal, but it doesn't quite click all of the, or like it doesn't tick the boxes of this is like really inspiring to play. And those are the cymbals that always get reworked in some way or get changed in some way. And it's like, I don't know, it kind of the line between subjectivity and objectivity when we're talking about this is, it feels blurry and it's subjective. Even those two criteria are probably subjective for everybody. So how we approach, but it is like, there is something about that even the way you're talking right now, it's kind of helping me see why I don't have a spark with a cymbal that's like, I feel like this is a great cymbal. Like, why don't I have a spark? Why isn't there a spark there that makes me go, this is a special one? What you're saying is kind of helping give language, I think, to that. And maybe hopefully it'll give language to even just drummers that are like sitting down with a cymbal and wondering like, do I connect with this? Do I want to buy it? You know?
Well, even though I've had so many drummers talk about bright and dark cymbals, and there's basically two versions of that. One, which is more common, they say, oh, this cymbal is very bright. All they mean is the note that they hear the most is higher. And so then that means it's a bright cymbal. Then if the note that they hear the most from the cymbal is really low, that's a dark cymbal.
Yes. Yeah.
But to me, it was always more about timbre, and that something with, I guess, like to put it as less notes. If you ask 10 drummers, what's the note of this cymbal, and they all sing the same exact tone, that's a bright cymbal. If you ask 10 drummers, what's the note of this cymbal, and they give you 10 different notes, that's a very dark cymbal.
Interesting. Yeah.
So yeah, but that can easily get confused. Someone says, oh, I'm looking for something dark, and then you make something. Yeah. Well, what a lot of people call complex.
Yeah.
But I would say even complex is beyond dark. Complex is no note. It's just a white noise. It's like a fuzzy radio,
Interesting.
You didn't tune into any station.
Right. Yeah.
So
the way I like to talk about that is with I guess relating it to video. If you're looking at like a 4K video versus something that's like grainy looking, you have this kind of compressed, squished kind of small file size, big pixels, and then the image itself feels kind of flat or squished. But with a 4K video, you just see all this depth and dimension to it in all different ways. And simple, I think simple yeah. sounds can be like that in a lot of ways. Like you're saying, like if everybody sings the same note, that's a bright cymbal. I would also maybe add to that, like there's like a compressed quality to those cymbals because they don't feel as wide, maybe, you know, yeah. like, and I really like the cymbals that feel wide in some way, shape or form, you know, you're.
Yeah. And it works in a nice way in the music, I think, mm-hmm. generally speaking.
Yeah.
But some of these factory stamped cymbals are often going to just have one very clear note.
Yeah.
Or like a very flat edge that's holding that note. If the edge flattens out a lot, it's going to prolong that one tonality towards the end. And it's no, there's going to be no discussion about which note that cymbal has.
Yes. Yeah. It's just known. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's very fascinating. Yeah. So do you find yourself making cymbals outside of the things that are your taste, or do you pretty much stick with like, these are the cymbals I love them?
Oh yeah. I make things that wouldn't necessarily work as well for me personally on every yeah. single gig and every single context, but that could work for something. And that's the real, I know I mentioned, you know, my teacher there, he played the same ride cymbal for 55 years, but that's not necessarily going to be the case with everyone. But if there's a cymbal that you can feel really compelled to have and continue playing for many years,
yeah,
it's kind of a very old fashioned mentality when things were, you know, made to last and there was no planned obsolescence and you just,
yeah,
you get the one toaster for life.
I love that phrase, planned obsolescence.
Yeah.
That's great.
But yeah, if I can create that someone feels really compelled by that one instrument for many years, then yeah, maybe only for the times that they play big band, but every time they go to play big band, aha, got them.
Yeah.
I have it.
Yeah.
This and is just the something sound. That's going to make your life easier. And that again goes back to the playability and the feel that it just makes your life easier.
Yeah.
To do what you want to do. That you're not fighting the instrument. You're not fidgeting with the hi-hat and doing this thing, you know, half of the gig.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I see so many drummers with that issue and they seem to have, you know, they're perplexed. They feel like it doesn't matter which hi-hats I get. They never fit together quite right. But yeah, there is an objective criteria and way to fix those issues that then you just set the hi-hats in any direction. You don't have to line them up with arrows or put holes in the bottom or anything, and they're going to just work. It's you're going to set up,
and then you're focusing on playing the music, not on like fidgeting with your hi-hat. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, you're looking at the chart, not at your left foot. Yeah.
Yes. That's what. Yeah, I find that to be the case with like I've played. I've done more like loud, you know, rock and roll, maybe like. I played up for a while in like the CCM Christian contemporary music world. And I did some jazz and oftentimes when I would approach situations where the drums were mic'd or I was in a cage, a lot of times the mentality was like, try to make the job of the engineer, sound engineer easier. And then he's happier because he's able to focus on like mixing the vocals and not like trying to figure out why there's so much cymbal bleed in the tom mics. And, you know, cause I'm actually playing the drum set so that I'm giving him something that, so it's like, you know, for anybody that as a musician, I feel like that's a great mentality to take to music. It's like, do your job so that everybody else is free to do their job, you know, like make everybody else's life easier. Like you'll get called for gigs if you do that. And then there's that mentality, obviously, with like making a cymbal. It's like, you don't want a cymbal that you have to fight, which I find a lot of the, like kind of the Meinl thing. I'm not trying to throw any name under the bus, but like Meinl has kind of come in and they've gone really thin, really dark, really dry. And anytime I get a modification in of a Meinl, it's usually just like a really quickly made cymbal that has like low tension, low shape. And it's one of those cymbals where you hit it in a certain place and like it's an objectively bad sound. Like you're not going to hit it up near the bell because it's going to honk like blaringly loud and it's going to be just really annoying. So There is like a sense where some of the bigger companies are like realizing that people, you know, in their minds are like, we want complex, we want dark sounds. And so they're kind of like figuring out mass production methods to make these cymbals that have a little bit more stuff going on. But because it is mass produced, you have, it's like, it kind of swings the pendulum to the other side a little bit.
Well, I did some work for some of those companies and some bigger manufacturers. And at the end of that, I realized their goal is to, it's not to make cymbals. They have a product that's to make product and sell product.
Yes. End of sentence, right?
Yeah, you have executives with spreadsheets and that's their goal. And sometimes the consumer is very pleased with what they get. But the idea of, you know, the family or that you're being looked after or something like that is no, that's, they have quotas that they need to make. They have the executives that need a certain amount of products sold. And if they can do absolutely no work to make the product, they'll do that. They don't have some kind of like ethical,
right.
This goes with almost all, you know, big corporations. There's no some like quality. If the consumer is saying, oh, we're cool with that, and it costs them half as much to make it and half as much effort, they'll put that out there.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Which is, I mean, it gives, and I could see how even just in the way that they market, they market as if obviously there's like care and attention put into these instruments. But it is like you say, it's very much like if you can cut, you know, and the idea of making like something really thin and it's really dark, it's really trashy, it's really dry. I mean, they can make those cymbals pretty quickly and they can crank a lot of them out.
And there's a lot of aspects that they know are a negative result on the sound and longevity or playability, but that's irrelevant. Right. Like the lacquer that you get on cymbals from major manufacturers, that's just so that the cymbal can sit at Guitar Center for a few years and they can still sell it as new.
Right. Yeah.
Even though they know that creates high frequencies that, you know, they're real hissy at the top and it doesn't let the cymbal patina in the same way. And I think most people would ultimately agree is not beneficial. Even if it's not detrimental, it's not beneficial.
Right.
Aspect of the process.
And that's totally it. Like it can sit in the music store for upwards of 2 or 3 years and not take on fingerprints, and it looks basically new. I talked to a buddy of mine who was saying that his cymbals were in a shop, he worked at a shop for a while, and he was saying the cymbals that came in that sat, that maybe didn't have the most robust clear coat on them and got fingerprints or got stick marks, those cymbals did not sell. It was like, even if people played them and was like, whoa, that sounds amazing, they look at that and they see stick marks and they go, oh, it's used. It's not, you know, it's not worth the brand new price. So they would pass over it. So there's like a lot of psychological, or the psychology of it is definitely a huge part to play in that.
I think it's just good that drummers out there know the reality of that. There's a funny thing. Maybe you've noticed this on K Constantinople's. There's a bell hammering pattern on the top.
Yeah.
But there's only one pattern. It's the same exact pattern.
It's random, but it's the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I would have thought they at least would do three just to mix it up. But no, there's only one hammering pattern that's designed to look random.
Exactly.
It's almost like they got like a focus group in to determine which one of these Rorschach tests looks the most random to you. They said, oh, yeah, B looks random. Okay, perfect. Send it in.
Get the machine, the CAD drawing, and then we'll just, you know, stamp it on 20,000 of these things.
Yeah. And if the bell there sounds great to you, that's good. But it's good to know what it is you're getting.
Yes. Yeah. And you're getting it for, you know, I was actually going to say you're getting it for a lower price. But nowadays, if you look at a K-Con, it's like they're great. They're just as expensive as like most of the indie guys.
Yeah.
Which I mean, I've talked to other guys about pricing, you know, because I try to live in both worlds, like the artistic world, the world of like, I just want to make the best kind of symbol I can make. And then I try to also live in that business world at least a little bit, so I'm not being like dumb with my time and my money. But I really do find I find that like pricing is a difficult thing to navigate, because on this side I'm looking at that, given what we're discussing, I'm like, I spend so much more time on these symbols to ensure they sound the way that I want them to, and ensure that they're more functional than like just like a, you know, random K-Con they bought online that they didn't hear it, you know. It's like throwing mud against the wall and seeing like what sticks, you know. But the market is not gonna, you know, they're gonna go, well, Zildjian is a 400-year-old company, and like, so why are you charging $200 more for a 22-inch ride than Zildjian? I mean, Zildjian is, and it's like,
yeah, well, absolutely. Well, yeah, they can know the amount of time and effort that independent makers are putting in. There's ultimately going to be some people that aren't convinced with what you're doing or what Zildjian, you know, there's going to be those people that if it's not an old K, they're not going to play it, or whatever. It's not a 602. But I think with the independent makers, it's not only offering something that was handmade, you know, one of a kind. Like, there is the aspect of the product that you're charging for, that they're not getting this replicable model, but it's also that you're offering your time, your expertise, that they can talk to you. And even after receiving it, they can ask you some questions about it. If they want to know how to repair something, if they want to know how to rivet something, like, they have you, the expert, who they have at their disposal.
Yeah.
Go
ahead.
Oh, well, that has been a bit of a disappointment to me with a lot more independent symbol makers on the scene. There have been one in my New York shop. There were a couple of independent symbol maker symbols that people got that, you know, didn't work out, or in the case of some of them, were cracking irreparably after 1 month or something. And people were bringing these in. Oh my God, I swear I don't play that hard. And I said, no, it's not your playing. Like, it's the way that these were made. It's just not good. Whether it's the case of, you know, unannealing the metal, or that particular the blanks were just no good to begin with. It's hard to say exactly. I think probably the first, like, you know, trying some flaming of the symbols or whatever. But the point of being an independent, even more than a company, is not to then just disappear. And that was the case with these symbols, that the independent maker said, well, I'm on to something else. Good luck. Have a nice life.
Yeah.
And then that does such a disservice, I think, to all of the other independent makers. So, because that is just as integral in what we're doing as the product itself.
Right. Yeah, there you are really paying for, you know, either Jesse, you know, you're paying for Jesse's symbol. And in that really is you, who you are as a person, your time to talk with them. I mean, I'm sure you have email threads that are, you know, 50 to 70 emails long, where you're just going back and forth and asking questions and learning about what the customer's wanting. Like, you know, that is a really big part of it.
So much a part of it that also the big companies aren't doing. And there were some drummers who had a contract with a big company, but they had no one to really talk to about the aesthetic that they wanted, about what they were going for. And then we would spend, you know, 4 hours at a time, maybe multiple times, of sitting down, listening to records, chatting about different symbols, them playing different things, saying what they like, what they don't like, showing me videos of different symbols. So, like, yeah, that's also what they're getting there.
Yes.
Not just, okay, we'll pull out the rack at the factory and just you choose and say bye, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's a good, like, I think that's a good check for a lot of symbol smiths. Cause I mean, I definitely feel the pull to, you know, I guess go the more mysterious route. Like, you're just the mysterious, magical symbol smith up in the woods, and you don't talk to anyone, and you release some symbols, and when they're sold, they're sold. And you don't really, like, you don't take requests or do anything like that. Like, there's a real pull as a maker to do that, because it's just less work, you know. It's less, yeah. it is actually difficult to, because like we were saying before, we have to get on the same page with our terminology. Like when this person says complex and dark and dry, what do they mean? So like, send me some references of what do you mean by complex or dark. And then I can, yeah. I have to like take that and discern it and decipher what they're trying to say, and then interpret that into how I make the symbol for them. And there's like, it's exhausting. It's a lot of work to do on that end of it. And there is always the pull to take the easy way out, I think, with really anything. But
the hope is that, I mean, each client that you're working with is going to have a different want and need. And there's going to be one person that really all they want is to just send you a message. I want to buy that 20-inch symbol. And you say, great, what's your address? And they don't yeah. want to talk more than that. They just want to get the thing.
Yes.
And then you never hear from them again, or you do the next time they say, I want this 22. And that's right. it.
Yeah.
But there are going to be other people that would like some more feedback, more of a dialogue. Even if you're not making something custom, they still want to talk to you. What was your thought process behind this? How are you working on it? Or can I come to your workshop and see how yes. it all happens? So how does it start? And they're going to have that level of interest. And hopefully, you know, you're able to, for the most part, accommodate those different levels of interest to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the difficulty of it can be a resource for you if you let it. Like I find that like getting into the mind of a different drummer and hearing their perspective helps me kind of formulate what I think about this instrument. You know, I find that I'm like constantly in, there's a constant evolution of learning with this craft. Like there really isn't ever going to be like an end point where I'm like, I am the ultimate symbol master. I've made, you know, I know how to make every symbol every way. I know how to, like, that's never going to be the case. Just like being a musician, it's never going to be the case. You know?
It's always evolving. And I would say if I hear things that I made very early on, there's
yeah.
some things that I feel are less professional, you know, things that are over 10 years old. But there is a certain naivety with those that is not replicable now.
Yes.
I couldn't undo the things that I know now. So it is always evolving, but to still be happy with that and say, cool, that was a different era, but I still like that is different than like, oh, I succumbed to a request that I really disliked.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
That only happened to me a few times that I, oh, really? It's, you want that? Okay. But
I guess I need the money. I guess I'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they try to coerce you enough into, no, it's going to be perfect for me. But it's, I know the reality that then that symbol might be the only one of yours that anyone ever hears.
Yes.
So
that kind of puts a little bit of weight on it, you know, like on the whole process. And I think, you know, cause yeah. I'm the kind of person that I just want to just get it out. Like if I think about a new percussion accessory product or whatever, I just want to like make five and then just release it. And I don't necessarily think like, okay, that logo of mine is going to be on that product that's out there. That's this weird one-off prototype. And I think there's like benefit to operating that way. But I think when you hit a certain stage in development, you end up becoming a bit more, maybe serious. Maybe, I don't know if serious has like a negative connotation, but you just become a bit more serious about what you're doing, and you don't take it so lightly. And there could be like I think there can be a really good way of being that way, because obviously as a maker, like you said, that's a really good check. Like if one person only ever sees this symbol of yours,
yeah.
will you be happy with that? Like that's a really good like litmus test gauge for like, is the symbol, do I want to put the symbol out there? You know?
Yeah. Or is this symbol I'm making, is it possible that someone could play that for their whole career and be happy with it?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So that's where I'm at. Anything that I'm making before, I'm saying it like the criteria, I know when I'm done making a symbol based on the playability and feel mainly.
Yeah.
And partially the look, you know, make sure that there's no really off putting things in terms of the look, but that's less important.
Yeah.
But then if I feel like, yeah, this is something that someone could play for many, many different gigs and for many years and still be happy with, then cool. Okay, then.
All right, it's ready. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you mess with doing series of cymbals, or do you just, is every cymbal kind of like, this is a 22 at this gram weight? What, how do you go about like marketing in that way?
I don't, yeah. In terms of marketing, the only series I've done were when I made replicas of someone's cymbal. So I was doing, for some time I was doing some replicas of that cymbal I told you about. That was my teacher's. Mm. I ended up getting to borrow it from his son for some time and made a very exact replica, and then made a series of other replicas of that.
Nice.
And I did the same for Al Foster's sound creation. That I had that for a little bit of time. I got it in my shop, and I was able to make the replica that he's, well, partially that he's used because he's afraid of, you know, traveling or getting the other one more damaged. But so I did like so a little series of those, and some other like kind of, you know, more historic symbols like that.
Yeah.
When it was a copy, like a specific copy, then I said, well, I'm going to do the copy. And then what do I do the copy? But it's a little lighter. It's a little heavier. It's a little lower profile, whatever. But otherwise, no, not exactly. Like, I'm not thinking, yeah, in terms of like a series name, the splashy trash crash. Right.
Oh, man.
Just,
one of these big companies, they're going to take that name and run with it and sell.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of units.
yeah. Splashy, trash, crash, splash. yeah. And well, no. Go on.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That I find myself. There's this thing. Have you ever heard of the Enneagram? Do you know what the Enneagram is?
No.
Essentially, it's like it's a weird, quirky little personality test that I got into for a little while. A while back, and I found that like my brain, I like to think about all the different perspectives of something and kind of take in everybody's mm-hmm. different opinion. And I don't usually have my own opinion. I'm kind of like gauging other opinions that are out there. So I find I'm like a chameleon in that way, or like an amalgam of what everybody else thinks. I can be that way, but I really go back and forth with this whole, you know, because I think I'm getting a little bit more serious, like you're talking about what I put out, because we are in an age, I guess, where there's a lot more cymbalsmiths out there, a lot of guys making stuff. Whereas, like, you know, when you started, it was what, like 10 dudes, or, you know,
even less. Yeah.
Less than 10 dudes. So now it's probably upwards of 100, or, you know, there's probably a lot of people that aren't posting or doing anything, but are actually making and learning the craft now.
Yeah.
And so we're getting to a point where there's going to be like kind of a flooding of the market, of marketplace for independent cymbalsmiths. And so I do think about marketing and like, how do you best, you know, give the customer something that they can understand, you know, so like maybe like a name of a type of cymbal, or a name that you designate as a certain kind of sound palette or whatever it is. But it's always kind of, I always find that I'm like in the middle trying to balance that, because obviously this extreme end is Zildjian, where it's like the K custom dry is this, and it's very like copy paste. And then the other end is like, every symbol is just like a unique creation. And then it's like, where do you live in there? And like, I think for all the guys that are getting into it, it's like, we all kind of have to make a decision as to what do we want our identity to be?
I think just you find your niche and your specific types of qualities that you like the most, and then run with it. And what you really like hearing and really like playing, and then really just try to develop that. It's the same as playing the instrument.
Like, so would you say, would that be your advice to someone just starting out?
Yeah, have a specific idea, hopefully even a concrete symbol like that you own, that you can say, yeah, this is something, and not just what people told you, something that you genuinely do like.
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting to me how much people talk about the K Istanbul's, but not the K Constantinople's, like the old K Constantinople's, and how many interesting different techniques they were doing in those times, just because, you know, mainly they made smaller symbols and oftentimes heavy.
Very heavy, yeah.
So it's not always as well suited to drum set playing, but there's still a lot of very, very cool aspects of those symbols that then you can even try to translate to a bigger symbol and say, oh yeah, that 14 is really neat. What if it was a 24? How would that be?
But
I can apply the same exact principles to that.
So what kind of technique is an example of that? Like, because I'm sure you're way more studied than I am on that era.
Some really irregular hammering, irregular shapes, but not warped, just shaped irregularly.
Okay, yeah.
You know, the bell is a pretty perfect shape a lot of the time. Those were essentially like pressed, a lot of those. But that the body of the symbol also sits flat, but the way that it goes, the profile is higher on this side and the bell is kind of crooked, even though it's, you know, so then when you set it on the stand, it's just a little bit. So not in this warped, you know, beyond the pale kind of way, which you can see from some other, you know, big time makers or even sometimes independent makers, then that's when it gets, you know, to the objective. Okay, well, that's just not in the shape of a symbol.
Yes.
Anymore, or it, that is detrimental to the sound. But just so many variables within the symbol is perfectly shaped, you know, set on a hydraulic press and ta-da, to the symbol is not in a shape that is resonating.
Yeah,
you have so many variables between that.
That's kind of talking. That's like diving into, you know, what do you do when you feel like you get your technique together? You feel like you can make a clean sounding cymbal that's uniform, sounds, you know, relatively similar all the way around. The bell's right, everything's right. You know, you get to that point, and then you go, okay, well, this is kind of boring just to make perfect, you know, perfect sounding things or perfect shaped things. Then you kind of work your way backwards to this place of like, okay, well, what if we take an irregular shape? Can not like minimal irregular, you know, like not like, like, oh, that was just like made really quickly and shoved out the door. But like, can there be a sense of refineness to the irregularity to it, to where it like works as a musical instrument?
Yeah.
But you're playing with all of this, like you're playing with chaos almost to create that. I really resonate with that a lot.
So yeah, I'm oftentimes, I have a little collection of old cymbals that are cool and weird. I have a Wuhan Spiz. That's a pretty funny old cymbol.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know if you know that story with
Spizzino. A little bit of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that they said, you know, no deal. And then a few months later, they started putting out Wuhan Spiz symbol.
I just don't know how do you go about fighting that when it's a different country? I don't, like, because I know he tried, like.
Yeah, and in China, there's not the same kinds of copyright laws. So, yeah, that happens a lot with manufacturers, but then things get copied and not returned.
Right. Yeah.
But he did manage to fight it, I think, somehow.
Okay.
Yeah. Or they just gave up, just that it wasn't selling enough. So.
Right. People kind of saw around it.
Yeah.
I've been very interested in like his, like the antique, because he had like the, was it the antiques, the bygone sound, the antique series? That was Spiz, right? Like that was maybe.
Well, he had the Ka series. That was like, if you want to call it a series, those were some that he was doing some different processes to in an attempt to make them more aged.
Yeah.
But that's the only one that I know of. Otherwise, I think he was just putting out whatever.
I think it was, I'm what I'm thinking of was maybe before he was actually out, like officially on his own. I think he kind of had a little company and it was called like the Antique something, the Bygone
and
Sound.
Before that, the Tiger series of UFIP. And Spizzino was just doing press bell blanks, and even pressed profile blanks in the case of some of those really very high profile
interesting
symbols, and some, you know, non B20, some B25, some B8. I have a blank from his old shop that was a pressed profile blank that's like B15 or something.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah. So, he was doing some heat treatment experimenting, right? To try to like,
yeah, which I would not recommend that to anyone. It didn't work for him. It's not going to work. But yeah. I mean, unless you have like a proper heat treating, like, you know, my pal Matt Nolan there has like the proper, but if you're just like taking a flame torch and throwing that on the symbol, no, it's not going to work out for
you. Don't do it.
Yeah.
There's a buddy of mine went to his friend's house, and his friend was like, you got to check out these new Spiz hi-hats that I got. And my buddy has a pretty heavy left foot. And so he said like within like, he like started playing a groove, and then within like four measures of his groove, the top hi-hat just split like from the edge all the way up to the bell.
Yeah. Just, and that's one of those that was being flamed on. Yeah. Cause it's just,
And the guy, you know, the guy had spent like, you know, $1,500 or $2,000 or whatever on that set. And I ended up getting the scraps of it. And it's like glass, you know, like it shatters like glass.
Yeah. I tried to repair some of those, quite a few of the, more than 20 of these Spitzkinos that had, you know, irreparable cracks in different ways. One of them, it was all these micro cracks all around. So it was very dead. It was one of the deadest cymbals I ever tried to play on. And I cut out more than 70 small cracks with the, you know, a small drill bit and a Dremel tool. And it still had more cracks.
Wow.
Then there's other ones that have the split. I have one here that someone just, they're like, just take it. That is split all the way from, it's a hi-hat cymbal split all the way from the end to the bell.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a mod in one time that was one of the original 30th anniversary prototypes. And it had a similar thing going on where it was like, I drilled out like easily 35 or 40 little micro cracks, and it still had more, and it was still super dead. And, you know, it was like, I'm sorry, I literally can't see. I had my little like magnifying glass trying to like scouring over the symbol. I was like, I can't find any more, but they're there because it's still dead. Yeah. You know?
So that's like just a piece of advice I would say to people working on symbols now. Don't do that. Don't try to flame the symbols. There's plenty of things that people did in antiquity that were not the best, you know, eating with lead and then dying of lead poisoning, but it doesn't, they did it back then doesn't mean you should do it.
Right.
Now.
Right. Yeah. What have you seen this thing of, I can't remember the name of it, but it's like a laser weld that people are doing. It's like a micro laser weld technique, which I've heard it has like, it can work okay for bell cracks. Obviously edge cracks is kind of a different matter, but
yeah. And there was some guy in the States doing that, and I saw some of those repairs. And hey, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Usually the crack, even not in the case of those instances of flaming, but usually the crack is going beyond where you are visibly seeing it.
Yes.
So just throwing in some laser weld into that area is still not necessarily going to, and it also just depends on how the symbol vibrates. If it's vibrating in a way that is going to accentuate that cracked area or not, because you have some symbols that might have gotten dropped in some way, or something bad occurred and you got a crack, but then the way that it vibrates is not pulling the material in two opposite directions. And then you're able to survive with that cut out or cracked area for, you know, ever.
I love the videos that Memphis put out about, have you seen those with, it was John Riley's vintage cymbal collection. It's like a 4-part series.
Yeah. I got to play some of those Ks when I was at MSM with him.
Okay, cool. Yeah.
He's got a nice collection of Ks.
Did you like them in person?
Yeah. They're all different. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I found that like, you know, those cymbals are, you know, you look at just like the specs of them, they're a good bit heavier than what, you know, people typically associate with jazz cymbals. You know, they're, I would find like the 22, he's got the 22 that it's like, yeah, this is 2,800 grams or 2,600 grams, whatever, kind of up in that like medium range. And that's something I'm kind of interested in is this, I play a lot of softer music.
Yeah.
I don't like hitting hard. So I really do like stuff on the thinner side, but it really does fascinate me, this idea of like, you know, making cymbals that are heavier, but make them to feel and respond and almost sound like they're a lot thinner than they actually are. But because they're that weight, they're going to have a sense of body and clarity that something, you know, 500 grams thinner is not going to have, you know.
That's, yeah, you can do that, but you can also do the exact opposite, have a lighter cymbal that plays heavier. And yeah, just with the, again, the tension and the hardness of the metal.
Yes.
Yeah. So these days, at least for me, because I'm carrying the stuff not often in a car, oftentimes on the train or something, I, for my, the purpose of my spine, I prefer to make lighter things that play heavier.
Play heavier. That's
yeah,
very interesting. With
that. But I know what you mean, that there's a certain type of ping and response that, yeah, it's only going to happen from something that is thicker.
Yeah.
But you can also experiment with how thick each area is. And yeah.
If you want to do have a thin cymbal, but you have more weight towards the edge, you don't quite taper it like you would something heavier. Mm-hmm. That could be a little way you get more clarity out of that, like main ride area, not the sweet spot, but like the main riding area, you know?
Yeah. So there's like a million variables to play with. Like, right. I know when I'm posting cymbals, I'm posting the gram weight, but that's really only a small portion of what it's really all about.
Right.
There's,
it's like a good, class. Yeah. It's a good classifier, but it's really good just to like take that information in and then just chuck it to the back of your mind and pay attention to the other stuff, like you're saying.
If you're shopping around, I think it is good for drummers to have some at least vague idea. I feel like a lot of drummers come and look, they say, I want a new cymbal, but it's like going car shopping and you don't know if you want a truck, you know, a Mini Cooper or a boat. And it's
right.
So at least if you can say, okay, I want this general size and this general kind of weight. And not just to say light or heavy, but okay, I've heard enough 20s around 2,000 grams that something thereabouts between 1,900 and 2,100 is probably what I'm going to want. And then you can get into all the other variables.
Right. Yeah. It starts you out. It's like, you know, you want a truck. So you're going to the dealership. You're like, I want a truck. And then you can choose between the 30 trucks that are there. Yeah.
Exactly.
That are all different and have plenty of different specs to them. But that's what I try to do. Like you said, thin cymbals that play heavy, heavy cymbals that play thin. I think as a maker, it's super fascinating to think about paradox and like, how can I make these two, or how can I merge these two like sound palettes that don't typically go together? You know, can I make something like really thin and fully lathe top and bottom, but make it really dry? Like, how do I do that? Like, it's not typically something that works given the way you're making it, but maybe there's like a combination of 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 techniques that you can kind of, you know, squish together. And all of a sudden you have this like paper thin cymbal that's really dry, but you've removed the crust. Like, how did that happen? That's just like, obviously off the top of my head, but it was like thinking in those ways. I find that it helps me tap into a more creative spirit, I guess, when I'm sitting down to make a cymbal instead of just like, I want to make a cymbal that's, you know, Tony Williams Nefertiti or whatever, you know, like the thing.
Yeah,
that
what does that mean? Yeah,
what does it even mean?
You're better off thinking in terms of how the metal works, and you know, to have success in working on cymbals, it's good to know quite a bit about cymbals themselves and music, but then you need to know a little bit about a lot of other things.
Yeah, like technology, like sound, like microphone technology in the 60s. Okay, you want to know about the Nefertiti ride. Okay,
yeah.
Can you find information about the venue? Can you see pictures of the venue? Can you take that and take that information combined with like, okay, what mics were they using? Can you find out that information? Then you start to realize, okay, well, then it's translating through my phone into my headphones. And like, what is the quality of my headphones? Or, you know, there's so many factors that change and color the sound of what we're hearing.
I've done some of those replica type of jobs over the years based on a recording, based on a video or something. But generally, I prefer if someone brings in the cymbal that they want replicated. Yeah. Then there is a pretty objective criteria there that you can say that that is or is not like the original because they're right next to each other. That can be sometimes, especially with the working with the wrong person, it can be a total fool's errand to try to recreate something.
I get the sense from you that you, because of maybe the nature of cymbal smithing and how much subjectivity there is, do you find that you really, you look for objectivity to kind of ground yourself in the midst of all this sort of perceptions and, you know, subjectivity? And is that something you connect with? Yeah. What can you do to make this like, what can you give yourself like a foundation at least, you know?
And nowadays, nowadays I'm only doing hand-formed bell cymbals, and each piece is going to work itself out. Even just when you're doing the bell shape, that's going to work it out in a certain way that it's already set you up objectively that this is going to have a certain volume cap and a certain way that it's going to play out with the bridge of the, you know, to the body of the cymbal. So I have to be realistic about that.
I'm kind of in that place too, where I'm really shying away from the pressed stuff. And, you know, obviously I would love to know your thoughts on this. Cause I'm thinking about like the making of a blank and they press the shape of that bell. And when I make something hand formed bell and there's like however many hundreds of strikes to, you know, bring the shape in, I think a lot about how much that material is thinning as I get it into the shape that it's in. And like you're saying, there really is like a volume cap and a sense of clarity that you are going to sacrifice with a hand formed bell. What's your process to kind of go about hand forming bells? Like what do you think about in that way?
Oh, it's changed over the years, but now I'm at a point that I'm not really cracking any of them because I have a sense of how thin that material is and how hardened it is. And even if I need to check it, you know, to drill some super small hole in the center and see how thin all the material has been pushed there.
And then just
push it a little bit more than that. But you're even hearing the response. It's just from working on enough of them. There's no tried and true thing. There's so many things that just from working on enough cymbal blanks and with enough bronze, you start to get an idea.
Yeah, it becomes kind of part of your foundation, and it's less of like step 1, 2, 3. It's more like it's an ingrained sense of knowledge that can kind of just come out when you're just sitting down with metal and the hammer, you know?
Yeah. Especially during the pandemic, I transitioned, you know, there was basically no playing happening. I transitioned to just working on cymbals. Just that's how it worked out. So I was just hammering cymbals 10 hours a day, every day, 7 days a week, until totally burnt out from that. But
a lot of terrible stuff came from COVID, but there's also a lot of like creative energy. I feel like people were like kind of building their creative identity during that time, because I was the same way. Like, okay, I guess I'll just go hammer cymbals, like you said, like as much as my arm would take in a day. And then you just like go to sleep, you're thinking, okay, well, tomorrow I'm gonna try this and this that I, you know, like that didn't work out so well on that cymbal, so next I'm gonna do this. And like that to me is like I never quite felt like I succeeded as a player, like, or I don't feel like I reached my potential as a musician and a player. Mm-hmm. And when I discovered cymbal smithing, I realized what I was lacking as a musician was really the curiosity that I had as a cymbal smith, you know, like the sense of like,
oh, that's great.
You just think about it all the time. You just have to know what would happen if you tried this. And I was realizing, like, man, if I'd had that sense of curiosity as a musician, that was like the missing ingredient, I guess, to maybe realizing my full potential in that area, you know?
And still within cymbalsmithing, I think there's a lot of room for different experiments and possibilities that still haven't been explored, even within from the cymbalsmith perspective, like the tooling that's used and the types of hammers that you use, types of lathing tools, and the way the lathe is built, and all these different elements, even just within the simplicity of those two. Just hammering and lathing, not any kind of aftershave.
Right. Yeah. Aftershave. Oh man, that's funny. Speaking of aftershave, do you mess with patinas at all?
No. Nowadays, not at all. No. I tried doing, like, I figured out how to make a cymbal look aged some years ago and had like a patina for that. But these days I do a lot of different finishes, but it's all from the lathe bit. It's not from buffing. It's not. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of these other processes of, it's cool if people want to get into it, but for me, it's all just the skill is within the simplicity of hammering and lathing.
Yeah. I like that. I think I'll probably get there. Cause I do a lot with patinas now as just kind of like little tiny flavor adjustments at the very end, you know? But I really do respect and identify that that's maybe where I'm going in the future, is this, that real simplified version of like the mastery and the craft. There's enough in just hammering and lathing, enough of a world to explore, that if you kind of dress everything up, if you're always dressing things up with other stuff, you're maybe not fully exploring the meat or like what's really there in the, at the core of what we're doing.
And like very, very subtle possibilities and differences just by using a different hammer in only this spot of the cymbal, or tensioning it exactly this way. And then, but you tension it that way, but then you lathe it this way. And how much did you lathe from each side? Which side did you start lathing on? How much did you take off from this area? Pushing the lathe bit?
So. Exactly. One of my favorite light bulb moments was realizing, because I just had this binary idea that like, oh, when your bit gets dull, you got to sharpen your bit. But that there was this light bulb moment where I realized, oh, if I use a partially dull bit, it gives me, there's an effect there as I'm lathing, you know, it's like a burnish and lathe process kind of at the same time. And then layering that, you know, it's another technique, another tool that can be used. And then you start to get out of this whole like, binary thinking. You start opening up to like, there are so many possibilities here. Like you said, it's endless. There's so many techniques that haven't been explored. There's even like materials. Like I know Nick Margarita is like working on trying to figure out a new material even to make the cymbals out of. Like there's so much stuff there. Or like his take on the B20 alloy, you know. Mm-hmm. There really is like a lot there to explore, which is exciting, I think, as there's more people, you know, a part of this, and as people become more aware that there's options outside of Zildjian, Meinl, Paiste, Sabian, whatever.
Which is cool. Yeah, there's a lot of different possibilities.
It is cool.
Yeah, but also this presumption of that some drummers have of the old case were great because of the material. And that's not the replica. No, there was nothing special about the material. It was, and I think that even that those kinds of presumptions do a disservice to the makers. If you say that about, you know, any cymbals in antiquity, no, it was the skill of the makers.
Yeah. Coupled with the fact that they're 60 years old now or 70 years old now, and the aging effects, and you have like kind of those two dynamics at play, and people like to make it like it's just a much bigger thing, or they mythologize that stuff beyond what it really needs to be, I find.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's just to appreciate the skill of what those makers were doing, whether it was for, even like in terms of the 602, you know, the original flat rides, like the skill of the people doing those. It's not the special material that they had.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just some dumb luck. No, it was really like careful consideration and close monitoring and trying a lot of different things until they came upon something that really worked. Mm. And then you see that with a lot of the modern flat rides don't have those same qualities, even though they like to go for them.
Yeah.
Because they're not examining it closely enough.
Interesting. Yeah. So here's a question. So, I mean, we probably could wrap up in a few minutes, but like, what do you see? Do you see there being kind of like in another 50 or 60 years, obviously in 50 or 60 years, old K's are going to be even like, I don't know, maybe it's $5,000 for a ride, an old K ride. Cause they're, you know, obviously it's a
maybe
limited.
Not. There was a time in not so distant past that they were very cheap. I know plenty of guys in New York got old K's for less than $100 in the 90s. So
yeah, exactly. So, I mean, what do you think about like the symbols, you know, you're making, we're making, what do you think is going to be the effect? Is there going to be a mythologizing about the earliest era of symbol smiths kind of in the 90s and 2000s and 2010s? Like,
maybe. I don't know. It's not my place to theorize. I just like making stuff.
Right.
and then all the dealing, like you said, with the marketing and those types of the pricing, I just, you know, you try to figure out a pricing that's just going to work for you, that you can feel comfortable about it and feel good that you're being honest and it's something that you would pay for that same thing.
Right.
But I'm not thinking of that in terms of, but the collectability.
Right. Yeah. I know that I've heard from people that knew Spiz that was one of the things he despised about what he did was just how people would buy up a bunch of his stuff and then turn around and like sell it for, you know, double the money or whatever. He was watching that happen to his work and felt like pretty offended that it was being exploited in that way.
He was a bit salty about that stuff, but it's ultimately what can you do about it? Or you could charge more and then that wouldn't happen or I don't know. There's the amount in the world and in life that you can do, and then things that are just beyond your control. So
yeah, exactly. Well, in wrapping, I do want to say I have had a chance to play many of your cymbals, and they're all fantastic. Cool. I've never come across one that I was like, felt like it fell flat at all. Like people usually brought them in to be like, hey, can you put rivets in this thing? Or you know, check out this cymbal, or check out the cymbal Jesse lathe for me. So you and Craig, I mean, I don't want to start listing names because I could probably list everybody's name as people that just inspire me to make good symbols. So I'm really appreciative that you took the time to like hang and chat and
absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
Definitely really great to connect, and we should definitely keep in touch with each other for sure. So
yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. This has been the Reverie Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Yeah. I'll catch you soon. Take care. Sweet.